this is Meg Malone, the Vermont Edition digital producer, and you're listening to the Vermont Edition podcast. This episode has been edited for clarity and brevity. Happy listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kekin for Jane Lindholm. After sometimes heated debate, members of the Vermont Senate passed legislation last Friday by a 17-13 margin that would require background checks for private gun sales, raise the minimum age for buying a gun to 21, and ban the sale or purchase of high-capacity magazines and bump stocks. The governor has said he'll sign it. Joining me from Montpelier to talk through how these new restrictions will impact Vermonters are three seasoned reporters who've been following all the debate. April McCollum is a reporter with the Burlington Free Press. April, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Alicia Fries writes for 7 Days. Hi, Alicia. Glad to have you part of this discussion.
Happy to be here.
And VPR's own Pete Hirschfeld joins us as well. Pete, good to have you on the show.
Good to be with you, Nina.
So before we start digging into the new gun legislation, I wanted to spend a little time reminding listeners, most of whom may be aware, but not all, how hands-off Vermont has traditionally been when it comes to gun control legislation and how we compare to other states. For instance, in Vermont, you don't need a permit to carry a weapon openly or concealed. Vermont considers the U.S. Constitution all you need when it comes to a permit. And I guess I was surprised that Vermont is the only state where this has always been the case. And this isn't limited to just Vermont residents. If you're visiting Vermont from another state, you can legally carry your weapon around without a permit. Pete, how unusual is that?
It's quite unusual, and that's one of the reasons that the NRA, among other gun rights organizations, often point to Vermont as being a shining example of what permissive gun laws can do for public safety more generally. We have very low rates of gun violence in this state, low rates of criminal violence generally, notwithstanding the fact that we have some of the most permissive gun laws in the country, and there are a lot of people that are against gun control who say, hey, Vermont is a state that's getting it right. If we could all be more like them, then we might enjoy the outcomes they have.
Well, considering how entrenched the state's gun culture is, Alicia Fries, how surprised were you to see these measures pass both the House and the Senate and then have a Republican governor say he'd sign?
I mean, I think at the outset of the session, nobody would have predicted that this legislation would even be on the table, much less pass both bodies and win the governor's support. We saw in late February the governor do a 180 on his stance on gun control, and that set the stage, I think, for pretty rapid action in the state house. After the governor came out and called for gun control measures, this was in response to a averted attempt at a mass shooting in Fairhaven, and
right with Jack Sawyer,
right, and the governor pointed to that as the single event that changed his mind about the need for these measures, and then immediately after, we saw the leaders in the legislature call for much of the same measures.
April McCollum, you've been watching all this debate unfold as well. What struck you as emotions started changing and opinions may have started changing?
Well, it struck me definitely the rapidity with which this happened. The arrest in the Fairhaven case was, I think, February 15th. And then it was within days that suddenly there was all this momentum, and Democrats who had some of these items like universal background checks in their platform suddenly were pushing for them in earnest. And of course, the Republican governor who was calling for some of these pieces as well, whereas none of his predecessors had called for some of these things. It was just a kind of a whiplash in terms of gun politics in the state. And certainly, I think the lawmakers who pushed these bills through and actually got them passed wanted to capitalize on that momentum and make a change before other issues took precedence or took some of the attention away from this kind of remarkable shift in the momentum around the issue.
Well, I want to play a little bit of sound from some of the debate that was underway. Chittenden County Senator Philip Ruth, a Democrat, has been a long proponent of gun control, and it looks like he used this opportunity to pass some elements of gun control that he's long been supporting. He said the bill would make a positive difference in a number of ways. Let's listen.
I believe, as has been expressed by people who previously opposed S-55, that it will help in all sorts of categories, suicide, mass shootings, and other moments of gun violence.
But on the flip side of that, you've got a fellow Democratic Senator, John Rogers, of the Essex-Orleans District, who viewed this whole issue very differently and I think echoes some of what we were just talking about with the culture in Vermont. Here he is speaking out against S-55, saying it marked the end of an era.
I think maybe if we pass this bill, maybe it is over. Maybe the Vermont I grew up in is over and it's changed. When I was young, it seemed like the people who moved here because they loved it here and they embraced our values and our heritage and our traditions. But it seems now that we've been overpopulated with folks who came here for different reasons.
Pete Hirschfeld, that quote has been getting all sorts of tractions in a lot of different news reports. What did you make of that when you heard it?
It recalls for me a conversation I had with a gentleman outside the State House. He had been standing there multiple days holding signs urging legislators to reconsider their approach to gun legislation this year. And in the course of our conversation, he said something that stayed with me. He said, This isn't about guns. This is deeper than guns. And I think he's spot on. I think that guns in this instance are in some ways a proxy for a broader cultural issue that is manifesting in Vermont and in the rest of the country in increasingly visible ways. And for the people that are opposing these gun laws, it's not necessarily always about the specific words in the bill. It's about a culture that they grew up with. It's about a way of life that they know that they feel is coming under attack from people that don't understand them and don't share their values.
What's interesting, Democratic Senator Dick Sears, representing Bennington, was one of the bill's co-sponsors, and at one point, I think on Friday, Sears said he no longer supported the bill and asked if he could remove his name from it. So there was switching of sides even as this was working its way through. Alicia Freese, talk about what that was all about with Senator Sears seeming to change opinions on a bill he was co-sponsoring.
Yeah, so the bill underwent some pretty significant revisions after it left the Senate and went to the House. The major addition was a limit on magazine capacity. So you could, what the House did was limit that capacity to 10 rounds for rifles and then 30 rounds for pistols, and that was really controversial both in the House and the Senate, and that was largely what Senator Sears was taking issue with. He, among others, was concerned that provision was essentially unenforceable. And he also had complaints more broadly that this legislation was rushed through. You know, he tried to point to a number of areas, he called them errors with the bill. So he was making the case that the Senate should be taking more time and rather than just accepting the House version should really be giving the legislation a more rigorous review.
Before we really start parsing out the details on this, I have one question. Is there a place that interested citizens can read this bill in its final form? Because when I went to check it out on the state's website, it's tricky to know which is the correct version. And when I finally thought I was looking at the final version, it was all marked up and really difficult to parse. Do either of you have suggestions on is there even a final bill that's cleaned up?
I don't know that there's one that's been officially, like when it passes into law, it will be on the site as an act. So that will be the official version. But the version that I've been looking at is if you search under bills and resolutions and you search for S-55, what was ultimately accepted was the House proposal of amendment. And there's an unofficial and an official version. The official version has the markup. The unofficial version
like
does
my,
not.
Looked like my term paper from days of old.
Yes. Yeah. So there's a lot of underlining and crossing out still, but you can kind of get a sense for what's in that, and we'll keep an eye out for the official act when it's published.
And if the words are not crossed off, then they're operative in this version of the legislation. So just pretend like the crossouts aren't there, and you'll have what they passed.
Gotcha. Well, so let's dig into this legislation a little bit. It starts, or one of the key issues is expanding background checks for private gun sales. So let's start there. Peter Hirschfeld, let me throw this to you. When will the expanded background checks and the other restrictions actually go into effect?
Oh, my gosh. You would do that to me, Nina. April, can you bail me out on this? Do we have the effective date right there?
Yeah. So actually, the most of S-55, with the exception of the bump stocks piece, and that includes universal background checks, will take effect on passage. So that means when the governor signs it, potentially this week or maybe early next week.
And April, walk us through the various ways a person can buy a gun in Vermont and how those transactions have been monitored in the past versus how they'll be screened now.
Right. So if you buy a gun from a federally licensed firearms dealer, you would go through a background check, which is the dealer would check with the National Instant Criminal Background Check System to see if you've been prohibited from having a gun. And so that would be that would be kind of the typical transaction that does go through a background check. What has not been included in that law in Vermont has been private transactions, not only private sales, but also private transfers of ownership or gifts or things like that. And so under this bill, two private individuals who want to make their own private transaction would go to a federally licensed firearms dealer. And that dealer would run the sale as if it were a sale from the dealer's own stock. So they would go through the background check, and the person could not buy the gun until they've cleared that background check.
So, Alicia, how is that enforceable? Who's going to be monitoring that? And is it the honor system or?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, the bill does make clear, you know, makes an effort to protect the federally licensed gun dealer from, you know, some liability concerns. You know, I mean, I think you could monitor online sales pretty easily, but if, you know, if people are connecting in other ways, it would be difficult to enforce. I mean, you know, people who had concerns about this provision of the bill said, you know, people are just going to, you know, go across the border to New Hampshire and, you know, if they want to comply, they'll cross the border and exchange in a parking lot. And if they aren't too concerned, they could just, you know, do the same thing in a Vermont parking lot. And there is an exemption for family members. So you could, you know, if a father wants to sell his son a gun, that doesn't have to, they don't have to go before a dealer.
And the question of enforceability is something that has dogged all of these provisions from the outset. The Attorney General's office said, look, when it comes to this magazine ban that you're looking at, the fact that you're going to allow people to continue to possess any high-capacity magazines that they're in possession of now makes it, in some aspects, virtually unenforceable because these magazines aren't serialized or date stamped. There's no way to track when they were
bought.
Right.
How do you tell if you've bought it now or, you're right, after the ban?
And the Attorney General did kind of walk that back the next day and said that it's just like any other law, like distracted driving or, you know, things like that are hard to enforce, that it takes some extra legwork, but it's maybe possible. But it's unclear how many resources law enforcement would actually want to put toward proving a case.
And we've had some law enforcement officers who have said point blank, I have zero interest in enforcing these laws. I am not going to dedicate any of my precious officer resources to begin enforcing a law that many of them, frankly, think is wrongheaded to begin with. So enforced. There are some real questions about enforceability. Lawmakers don't seem to think that that's reason not to move ahead.
And they point to, you know, there are certain opportunities when it comes to the magazine limits to enforce them. The point of sale, you know, so if a gun dealer is openly selling these magazines, that would be an area where they could catch them. But that's, and they also make the point that this would, you know, by making them harder to get, you're going to reduce the overall quantity of the magazines that are out there.
And they'll also say, you know, when you look at this affidavit in the Fairhaven case with Jack Sawyer, there are these little stumbling blocks that he ran into along the way that a lot of people feel like were the reason he wasn't able to accumulate the weaponry needed to follow through with the threats that he was making. And a lot of lawmakers are saying, look, is this going to, in and of itself, going to stop gun violence? Of course not. This package of gun legislation is not going to end all the problems. But we can create these little obstacles that may, in some circumstances, avert what could otherwise be a catastrophe. And for that reason alone, despite all the admitted shortcomings, this makes sense.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about the new gun control measures recently passed in the House and Senate that are awaiting signature from the governor. My guests today are April McCollum. She's a reporter with the Burlington Free Press. Alicia Fries is with 7 Days. And Pete Hirschfeld is with VPR. They're helping us parse out the details. I'm Nina Keck in for Jane Lindholm, and you're listening to Vermont Edition. We're talking today about the details of what's in the S-55 new gun bill, soon to become law. We're joined today by Alicia Fries, April McCollum, and VPR's Peter Hirschfeld. I want to talk about the legal age for gun purchases, which lawmakers have decided to bump up from 18 to 21. That might have had an impact on Jack Sawyer as well, who's under 21. But to clarify, you can still have a grandfather give his granddaughter a shotgun or a hunting rifle for, say, her 16th birthday. Am I right on that, April?
Right. The prohibition is on a person shall not sell a firearm to a person under 21. So at least the way that I read that language, it looks like transfers and gifts and those kind of things would still be allowed for young people who want to hunt or anything else.
And Peter, listening to lawmakers debate the age issue, what were the main arguments for and against on that issue?
Just very generally that maturity levels and impulse control and all the things that we presumably develop as we become adults aren't yet fully formed in people between the ages of 18 and 21, that owning a gun is a massive responsibility, that misusing it comes with massive consequences, and they just don't feel that people at that age are necessarily ready to undertake the responsibility that owning a gun comes with. Now, there are some pretty significant exemptions in here, wherein if a young person takes a hunter safety course, for instance, they would be able to show a gun dealer a certificate of some kind indicating that they had gone through that course, and then they would be allowed to buy a gun. So this isn't a blanket ban or prohibition. This is saying if you're 18, 19, or 20, you're going to have to demonstrate to us a certain level of proficiency when it comes to firearms before we sign off on you becoming an owner by virtue of buying one yourself.
1-800-639-2211, the number to call if you have a question for any of my guests today. We're talking about the new gun control legislation. Let's take a call now from Island Pond. Jacob is on the air. Hi, Jacob. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
My question was, so I know in the provision, the new law bans high-capacity magazines, which basically consider handgun magazines that carry more than 15 rounds as high capacity. But a lot of different handguns that are chambered in 9mm or 40 caliber already, they handle more than 15 rounds. So I was wondering how that would play into this new law.
Who wants to take a crack at Jacob's question?
I believe Jacob is talking about a gun that could carry in excess of 15 rounds without those rounds being held in an attachable magazine to that firearm. And I think it's the magazine itself on which legislators are applying the prohibition. So my understanding is that if you can chamber more than 15 in the gun, that you would continue to be able to do that so long as you weren't using a magazine to facilitate it.
I hope that answered Jacob's question. I just wanted to point out that the gun sales in recent weeks, including high-capacity magazines, have skyrocketed in Vermont. Gun owners say people have been buying up these things because of the new restrictions making their way through the legislature. And I'm wondering, how does that worry lawmakers and this whole enforcement question, just because it seems as though now the market's even more flooded with these
right
things.
And we saw just this past weekend
right.
an effort to give away what was a 1,200 30 round magazines on the state house lawn. I don't think it's entirely unexpected. These things tend to happen when there's even talk of gun control legislation. So lawmakers did write into the legislation that the gun dealers have until October 1st to basically get rid of their stocks of high capacity magazines. So they were sympathetic to at least the gun stores that need to get rid of the inventory, although it sounds like these gun stores are going to have to restock multiple times before the fall to meet the demand that's out there.
Well, the new legislation also bans rapid-fire devices known as bump stocks. April, why don't you remind us what bump stocks are?
Yeah, bump stocks are, they've been described as like a novelty item. They're something that would increase the rate of fire of a semi-automatic weapon to make it more similar to an automatic weapon. I think a lot of people became aware of them after the Las Vegas shooting, where there was a bump stock in that case. So these would be banned starting October 1st of this year under the law.
All right. Brad Cornelius posts, I think it's important to keep in mind that S-55 is both a regulatory and expansion bill in terms of gun rights. The media coverage is heavily weighted towards what this bill does in terms of gun control, but overlooks what it does to expand gun ownership. Namely, it allows the state to sell firearms which were seized by law enforcement and put them back into circulation. He goes on to say, I believe it's around 460 weapons that the state was looking to auction off, and this bill will allow them to do that. So while it presents some restrictions based on age and ammo capacity, it's also promoting gun ownership by facilitating the sale of guns previously removed from circulation.
And it should be noted that that particular provision was very much supported by the gun rights advocates that are opposing the rest of the stuff in this bill. They very much would like to have an opportunity to purchase some of those weapons that have been in storage, and so they're happy about that. What they are very unhappy with is that legislation has since been used as a vehicle to advance all of these other components.
So I think one of the $64,000 questions that's floating around now, Jameson Dunn posted this, is what might be the political fallout for Governor Scott from signing this legislation? Alicia, what do you think?
There are a lot of people and, a lot of members of his base who are really upset with him. And that's a fact that he readily acknowledges in public. He is a very popular governor. I think the most recent public opinion polls were taken before the gun reform movement began. But, I think he still has a strong base of support. But, if he sees challengers, he's already – Keith Stern has announced his candidacy and would be running to his right. Another strong candidate running to the right of Scott could cause some problems for him.
And I'm wondering about other just lawmakers. We saw the big turnover after civil unions many years ago. Do you see this as sort of another watershed issue where a lot of lawmakers are going to lose their seats, Pete?
We will find out. It's what's amazing to me. There's two strains of thought on this, right? There is a growing sense that the rush of new activism around gun control will provide political cover to people that are willing to vote yes on something that would have formerly been very politically toxic for them to get behind. And whether or not that bears out is going to be one of the more fascinating political questions of the 2018 election cycle in Vermont. Phil Scott is presumably going to win the respect of a lot of centrist Democrats or even liberal Democrats in the state who support gun control. But whether or not they are going to be able to overlook some of the other elements of Phil Scott's platform that caused them not to vote for him the last time remains to be seen. And I think it's probably unlikely that Democrats are going to start voting for Phil Scott en masse because of this. There's just an incredible wave of anger right now among a lot of people who want to see Phil Scott pay for this. They really want to see him pay. They think he has sold them down the river, that he's a two-faced sellout. I mean, you read the comment sections and a lot of the gun stories, and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. So as we follow, I think that's going to be one of the things all of us in our business are looking at in November and in the primaries is what is the cost for people that voted yes.
But when it gets to individual lawmakers among the Republican base, it's interesting that even though the governor is supportive of all three of the bills that are moving forward, including S-55, only a handful of Republicans in the House voted for S-55. None of the Republicans in the Senate ultimately did. So in terms of kind of the backlash that might be coming from the Republican base, I think those lawmakers were very in tune with some of the frustration and anger from their own districts and ultimately didn't support this bill.
And there are a lot of House members in particular who maybe supported these bills in concept but would have faced major blowback from their constituents because of the region that they live in, the composition of their districts, who ended up voting no. The House could afford to lose some votes from people, and so there are people who did contemplate the political consequences of how they were going to vote before doing so and allowed that to kind of guide their yes or no decision. So that could buffer them against what might have otherwise been a more serious consequence in the fall.
Listeners, we're talking about the details of the new gun bill soon to become law, and we're taking your questions. We're joined today by Alicia Fries, April McCollum, and VPR's Peter Hirschfeld. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kekin for Jane Lindholm. We're talking about the details of what's in the new gun bill. We're joined today, rather, by April McCollum of the Burlington Free Press, Alicia Fries of 7 Days, and VPR's Peter Hirschfeld. Let's go to Concord now and take a call from Victor. Hi, Victor. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Nina. My question is whether or not this bill or any of these bills that have come up in other states, not that anybody on the panel would know this now, or on the federal level, has a simple clause in it that if anyone posts hateful speech like I'm going to kill everybody in my school on a social media site, that they would immediately be temporarily disqualified from owning any firearm until they were 21 years old or even beyond that. It seems so simple, and a lot of people I know in the Northeast Kingdom, when Phil Scott signs it, he might be finished because they're not going to vote for him. People who have had firearms for 40, 50 years and never done anything. And in Vermont, there's never been anything like this before.
Victor, let me throw your question to my guest. Who wants to take a stab at Victor's point about social media?
Well, I have seen some reporting that the Senate may be looking at threats and penalties that may happen when there are threats against groups of people. And so that might be something that they take up in a different bill. It's not part of S-55.
What they have done, though, in what I think most lawmakers would point to as the most significant piece of gun legislation they're passing this year, is set up a system whereby police can identify people who they perceive to be a risk to either themselves or others, and then go through a court process where a judge could order that that person turn over their firearms to police for up to 6 months if they're deemed to be, the term is, an extreme risk.
Well, is that S-221, that the piece of legislature that's currently
that's
still being
right.
debated?
That's right. That's S-221. Now, it's still has a couple more votes, or maybe one more vote left, but it's an uncontroversial bill. I believe it passed unanimously in both chambers. And simply posting something threatening on Facebook or Twitter alone is not enough to get you to lose your gun. But that may trigger the kind of investigation and process that 221 envisions, wherein police would be able to get guns away from people like the shooter in Parkland, for instance, who so many people had identified as a possible threat, and yet he continued to have these firearms that he ultimately inflicted this catastrophic damage on the school. So they feel like 221 is going to be the way that we can target individuals that we have a decent sense may do something bad with their guns, and then take those guns away from them before they're able to do that.
Well, and I know one concern that I've heard from law enforcement with this, and potentially with H-422 that I want to talk about in just a couple minutes, is, so you confiscate weapons, what do you do with them? Where do you store them? And I've talked to law enforcement that say, okay, well, what happens if you confiscate someone who's got a really valuable and massive gun collection? That person might be deemed a risk. You take the guns away, but then often these small town police stations are not spacious, or they may not have a good secure storage area. How does that fit in? What you actually do with the weapons that you confiscate, and who stores them? April or Alicia, can one of you weigh in? And have you heard about that side of it?
Yeah, that was discussed a little bit today in the House Democratic Caucus in the context of H-422, the bill that allows for removal of weapons in cases of domestic violence. And my understanding is that the bill contemplates that law enforcement would store the guns themselves, but and I don't know the full answer to this, but apparently there's something else in the law in terms of relief from abuse orders where a law enforcement agency can contract with a firearms dealer to hold those weapons for them. So I'm not quite clear on whether that might come into play with H-422, but we'll be looking into that more.
And where is H-422? Pete or April, maybe you can remind listeners exactly what's in that bill and where it stands in the process.
So H-422 is a piece of gun legislation, but really what folks say is that this is a domestic violence a piece of legislation that's designed to reduce incidents to domestic violence in the state. And it does that, they say, by allowing police to temporarily remove firearms from the scene of an alleged domestic assault. The statistics will tell you that the most dangerous time for a potential domestic violence victim is the days after police have intervened in the situation. The abuser has been found out. They're reeling. They're trying to they're in a very unstable place sometimes. And the argument is that if you have a gun in that environment, it increases the likelihood that the abuser is going to use that gun to harm or kill their partner. And so H-422 would, as I said, allow the police to temporarily remove that gun. It also requires that a court arraignment be held the next business day. There are a lot of due process concerns about this bill. You're basically just empowering a cop to, at his or her discretion, take away somebody's right to bear arms, to search the house. It's since been modified so that the police officer is not allowed to conduct a warrantless search of the house. They can only take firearms they find in plain view. But domestic violence awareness advocates say this is still a really important step forward in getting guns out of the hands of abusers, and that they think it will help reduce incidents of gun violence.
And that bill passed the House last year. This was going even before the Fairhaven and the Parkland cases that had already passed the House. The Senate had some changes, and then it is due to be voted on again in the House and finalized in the next couple of days.
Okay, thanks for the update. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Let's go to Walden and take a call from Bob. Hi, Bob. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, good morning. Hi, Nina. Good morning. I'd have a comment and a shout-out. The comment is, I think the passage of these bills is a great success for democracy, for the majority to pass laws for public health against the special interests of a small group. And in that vein, I'd like to shout out and really praise Governor Scott for his ability to change his mind and come around on this issue, and also Senator Dick Sears, who I know was opposed to the magazine limitation, but allowed the bill to go to the floor to be voted on. And I think all of our citizens who support sensible gun laws should support and let these two legislators or governor know and thank them for that.
All right. Thanks for that call. We've got time for one more quick comment. Mark, if you can be brief, go ahead from Bethel.
Yeah, I'm just wondering why there's such a massive effort in Vermont on gun control when they found out in Newtown they're teaching social and emotional education as well as mental health. That's not been a part of the deal in Montpelier. Why is mental health left so far behind in this state?
Wow. Well, that sounds almost as though we need to have a whole entire program to talk about mental health. And unfortunately, we're going to be out of time if we delve into that. Mark, I'm sorry we can't touch on that, but I think we've had a good chance to kind of delve into some of the issues with the recent gun control issues. I want to thank my guests today for joining us. We had Alicia Fries of 7 Days, April McCollum of the Burlington Free Press, and VPR's own Peter Hirschfeld. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
With you.